of the education as well, and that it was just wrong to have one or the other of these various branches suddenly selected and said, you're the operating head of this thing. You should really have been getting experience and training all the way through your career, so that when you did get to become the head of the technical services branch, you had knowledge in more than in one area. And also, when you as head of the technical services branch, if you're responsible for designing the next generation of ships, you wanted to be doing it with people who had served in the ships at various levels, you know. Not with people who had gone to sea as sub lieutenants and had never been to sea again, you know, and they were now captains and commanders putting a ship design together.
Yeah, this, of course, was the problem, wasn't it? You had to have certain sea times.
So, I simply throw that in, not sour grapes or anything else, because I think my concept was vindicated, because some very notable people have emerged from the non-executive side. But I believe it was a tragedy that it was thrown out so arbitrarily, and I think it'll come back.
Things were thrown out arbitrarily in those days, weren't they, in the 60s, right. And integration and something, my God.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
And you yourself, I think, said that so many committees started up and were fired before they got halfway through.
That's right. Yeah, you didn't like the sort of thing they were coming up with, so you'd fire that committee and appoint another group, and you'd have a group of unemployed committee members.
Yeah.
Anyway, it used to be that... I had no real sympathy from the personnel side. They were all for dismembering the TISDL, from the personnel branch of the Navy. They were all for dismembering the system. I had a real supporter in the form of then Commodore Harry Porter, who was really my opposite number on the staff side, and he believed in the TISDL system as passionately as I did. But unfortunately, he got promoted to Rear Admiral and was sent off to the West Coast while the battle was still raging. And whoever his successor was didn't feel very passionately about it at all. So, enough said about personnel.
I do have one question about personnel. Did you have any say in the acquisition of or the selection of junior officers for the engineering or the constructor branch?
Yes.
Did you take people in from the universities in the old way, or did they go through the service colleges and then go on to, say, the RN engineering schools, or what? How did it work?
Well, latterly, people were recruited as officers through the service colleges and got sort of general training there, and then were selected for postgraduate training later on at places like MIT and so on. Naval training established at Monterey in California, or one or two training establishments in Britain, plus some of our own. Yes, we did have a say. It was in the process of having that say is where we really got unstuck and where the TISDL system fell apart. Because classifications. We did away with branches and we introduced classifications. And the various classifications had to have job specifications written for them. And I was in charge of writing the job specification for the engineering, the various engineering classifications, or sub-classifications. And Commodore Harry Porter had the responsibility for the one for the staff side. And we agreed that after a lot of meeting on the subject, that since we believed in the TISDL system, that the job specification that I wrote for my people would be identical with the one that he wrote for his, because that's what the to the receiver's phone.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So we produced two specifications, one called Maritime Engineer at the top and the other called something else.
The equivalent of executive officer.
Yeah. And presented these to the personnel branch, and all hell broke loose.
Yeah, I think so.
And, but, you know, we had come right out and said it in print. And I can remember an Air Commodore Lobman, I think it was, whose job was to coordinate these job specifications, almost had a fit when he saw this. And we had invited teams of junior officers to come to Ottawa to sit down and write these specifications and to edit them and amend them and everything else based on their experience. And his immediate decision was to disband these two teams and send them back home immediately. But with a bit of pleading, we managed to keep them. And we ended up with two specifications that had different words in them, but still meant much the same thing. However, slowly but surely, the specifications were modified and went back to look more like the old branch system. But I'm convinced now that they're probably, the wheels made a circle, and they're probably coming back again.
Hmm. Well, that's very interesting.
No, it was just an interesting thing.
Yeah. And this particular thing took place in, what, about 1967 or 8 or
something? No, I think it might have been even earlier than that. Yeah, 67, 68, I guess.
In the unification, theoretically, had taken place. Well, and actually had taken place at this time. And.
But we were operating in the old way
and
slowly moving towards the new system. Mm-hmm. They'd had a study team who... under Commodore Hennessy, I think it was, who had produced this classification system, and they had decided on the number of classifications and things that you needed, which in effect did away with a lot of branches and sub-branches and amalgamated them into others. But in some cases it created new ones where the old ones didn't exist or had existed and brought them back.
Yeah. Well, was there any thought of having a unified engineering force in the armed services?
Yes, there was, and that was a bit of a battle that was being fought all the time too, because there were some people who said we should have a unified communications and electronics
mm-hmm.
branch, I think it was. Who would provide the communications and electronics equipment for ships and for airplanes and for remote radar sites and all of this thing. The only trouble was that there just wasn't enough time in a young officer's career to go and become a communications and electronics expert in every damn thing, airplanes, airplanes and Argus airplanes and DDH-280s and radar sites at Inuvik and all of that. It was just too much. You would get to see maybe once in his career or twice or something. Well, then you didn't have a really good well-qualified seagoing person, you see, to operate and fire the weapons.
Just too much to absorb.
Yeah. But also, we wanted people who not only designed and could repair these things, but could operate them. Because if you, just with the electronics and weapons system in a ship, if you carried around one set of experts to fire the damn weapons and another set of experts to repair them, there was an awful lot of duplication. Hey, you can't repair them while you're firing them anyway. So it made a lot of sense to have the one officer responsible for the weapon system and for operating it when it needed to be operated and for maintaining it when it needed mm-hmm. to be maintained. But by the time he'd mastered all that, he had enough. He didn't have enough time left to go and be, become the expert on the same thing in the air and elsewhere.
He spent his whole life.
That's right. So, but there were, to be fair, there were two or three areas where you could amalgamate, and I think in the construction engineering, as it's called. Navy called it civil engineering and maintenance, and I think the Army called it construction engineering, and, or at least the Air Force called it construction engineering, and I think the Army just called it engineering, which is what the sappers did. But those three groups were put together in a branch, and basically they all looked after buildings and land and property and so on. And it is possible, I think, for one person
to know that, to look
after the whole thing.
Same thing, just in different places.
Because a barracks on an airfield is not that much difference from a barracks on an Army base and so on.
Right.
So that in that area it worked out all right, and they were combined. But the attempts to combine the communications electronics, I think, was doomed to failure. When I left the service, they still had a communications electronics branch, but it was basically replacement for the old Air Force communications electronics branch. It wasn't really covering the other two services. The supply branches, to a large extent, were integrated, and we had supply officers who were serving in all three. But naval architects, no. Marine engineers, no. And marine weapons officers and marine combat systems officers. They're just really, that was too big a specialty in itself to start lumping in with anything else.
Yeah, I can understand that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you were then still in the forces headquarters in 1968, around there, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
You were still. What was your feeling? I don't know if we covered this of a sort of morale problem in the Navy or in the services generally with all this sort of chopping and cutting and moving and nobody really knowing what the hell.
Morale problem wasn't really as bad as it might have been. Although there was chopping and changing all over the place. And there was a lot of unhappiness just because of the uncertainty. I think most people who were confronted with changes they didn't like felt that if they fought hard enough, they could get them changed again, you know. So that was going on really all the time that I was around. But there is no doubt about it that an awful lot of very highly qualified and outstanding officers did quit this in 1965-66, rather than go into the type of organization that they were being asked to go into. So that I think morale, perhaps among very senior officers, was worse than it was lower down, because a lot of people just saw their career path suddenly come to an end. General so-and-so or Admiral so-and-so was jumped over everybody else and stuck in the job and effectively blocked that off for 5 years or 4 years, and that was it. So there was considerable unhappiness there, but I think among more junior officers and men, it wasn't as bad as it might have been. I think there's more unhappiness now that the fight has been lost for some of the things that they were fighting for. I don't think anybody really thought that the green uniform would survive as the only uniform. You know, I think people thought that you'd still wear your blues at sea and the Air Force would wear something else. But I believe that battle has been lost by those who were fighting for it. And I think it is causing some morale problems now. But those problems hadn't come to the really serious point, I don't think, when I left. But there were lots of people on the side qualifying themselves to do something else in case they got to the point where they couldn't stand it any longer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I must say, in 1967 and 68, took two investment courses.
Yes, I saw your certificate on the wall right there.
I, in fact, didn't use them until 1973 when I mm-hmm. finished my career. Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps I could just go on to the final stage of my career. And after 5 years as Director General of Maritime Systems, and I had been advocating all along that since I was only one branch and I'd tied up a job that about five other branches would all like to compete for, that it wasn't fair to have anyone in that job for too long. And I was advocating that it should be rotated about every 2 years just to give other people a chance. But that was not to be. It was not accepted, and I was left in the job for 4 or 5 years. But because I had various applications on file to go and do something else in order to clear the deck for someone to follow me, I eventually, when I had about 2 years left to serve, 2.5 years left to serve, I was offered the job of being seconded to the Defense Research Board mm-hmm. in the Operations Research and Analysis Establishment. And that establishment, which has about, which is right alongside the defense headquarters in Ottawa, in an old military stores building there, had I'm not sure of a total, but I guess 70 or 80 scientists in it who are operational researchers, and then there's another 20 or 30. People stationed at various military bases around the country. So I guess we're responsible for about 100 scientists, broken down into a number of directorates. And the head of that establishment is a very well-known scientist, Dr. George Lindsay, who was, I think, only the second chief of that branch had had in the however number of years it had been in service. The first one was a Dr. Sutherland, who unfortunately died rather young. And Dr. Lindsay took over in about 1965, I guess. And he'd been in operations research ever since the war, and he was a very, very able person, and he was being earmarked for greater things. And they wanted to send him to Quebec City with his family for a total immersion in France. And so they were looking for someone who would come and be his deputy for a year and then take over from him for a year while he went and did his French immersion. And so I was picked for that job. And I found it most interesting. I worked for a year under as the deputy to George Lindsay, and then for another year as the chief, and then for about a year, no, 6 months or so after he came back, as a deputy again,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I retired from that position. But I enjoyed very much working with the defense research.
So, were you researching? Or what were your programs, presumably?
Well, you know, an awful lot of them had pretty high-sounding titles and all top secret or secret, so I guess we can't name too many.
Oh, okay.
But we had...
Well, for
things
some things that are out in common use right now, what were you working on? I mean, some things that are not that.
Well, sonobuoys, for instance,
yeah.
And underwater detection apparatus
mm-hmm.
and all that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. We were very up to eyes on that. Not the hardware, but the evaluating its operational use.
I see, yeah.
And the establishment was divided up into five or six directorates. There was a director of Maritime Operations Research, a Directorate of Air Operations Research, Director of Land Operations Research. Then there was another one, Director of Mathematics and Statistics, who played with the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another one which was General Analysis, a group of scientists who did studies in areas that didn't properly fall into any one of the other three. Studies in management concepts and that sort of thing. So there wasn't anything that went on in the operational side of the three services that we didn't have some sort of an input in and didn't have a bit of a study going on. And my most interesting study that I was personally involved in, and I was just reminded of it three or four days ago when our Prime Minister was touring Northern Norway. I was made the Canadian head of a joint Canada-Norway study that was done on behalf of NATO to study the problems of the defense of Norway, in effect. And NATO had divided the whole European theater up into sectors. So there was a southern flank, and there was a northern Norway, and Sakland area, and so on, Atlantic area. And a Norwegian civilian from, it was an assistant deputy minister, I think, in the department, was the Norwegian head of this study group. And we worked for the best part of a year or so, I guess, on the study. Eventually put a report together, took it to Ottawa and presented it to our own masters there, and to Oslo and presented it to the Norwegian masters, and then took it to Brussels and presented it to the NATO Military Committee as a whole, and they sort of placed it alongside all these other reports they had, and then put together another one. Now, I don't think even at this late date that one can go into the details of that, but the sort of problems that you were faced with was a law on the books in Norway that says that you can't have anything nuclear on Norwegian soil in peacetime. But since the length of time between peace and war can be one day, you know, how do you get the nuclear thing there?
Indeed,
if there is a war? And so that's the sort of problem that existed then and exists now.
Well, they're talking about putting Canadian armored vehicles in northern Norway to be picked up in due course by our troops if they're needed.
Well,
that sounds extraordinary to me. They got time to get there. My gosh, the Russians have sure got time to get there first, I should think.
Well,
if they want to.
the real thing is, and I mustn't go very deeply into this, but the sort of question, should you be allowed to have some devices there that would not be in use, but could be put into use the moment the war started, you know, have them physically there, ready to be activated.
Rather like we have
a coma. With no transport involved. Things are there, but they're in mothballs or something. And, but
all those problems,
somebody got them locked up under a key.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was the sort of thing. And but it was
those are very interesting conferences.
We had a lot of interesting conferences. I wasn't part of the actual working party. We had some very competent scientists, Mr. Jack Trotman representing Canada. And I can't remember the name of the Norwegian lieutenant colonel, but we did have a competent group who worked full time, and then from time to time the steering group, which I was part of, would meet and with them and review the progress and then take it a step further.
In fact, you were doing strategic studies.
Well, the Defense Research Analysis Establishment really was the Center for Strategic Studies. That's basically what we were, and that's what operations research is all about in a lot of areas, too.
Yeah.
Anyway, I finished by my career while I was serving in the Defense Research and Analysis Establishment, and went to retirement on, I think, 1st of August 1970, or retirement leave, August 72, but I hadn't leave it extended in 73. I think I mentioned this to you either off the air or on the air, I can't remember earlier on, but within 2 or 3 months of retiring, I received a funny letter from the pensions branch saying, please can you you know, we know that you were born such and such a date and you're therefore going to retirement on such and such a date. But in order to calculate your pension, we want to know when you started. And we have no record, we can find no record that you ever joined the outfit in the first place.
I think you did mention that. Yeah.
This is rather, I think it was probably on the side, but it was rather shattering. See? And could I somehow provide some proof of when I joined and that I had joined and not just come in through a side door somewhere? Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, please, won't you just go and look at my file? Because, you know, every day since I've been in the service, I've been little pieces of paper accumulating.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, yes, sir, but we've got news for you. We hired a bunch of students last summer to put the files on microfilm, and they were told to save the important bits and to throw away the unimportant bits, and they weren't too well briefed, and everything got thrown out, in effect. Yeah. And the only file we have on you is, you know, about 70 pages. And I had a look at it, and there was nothing there that was worth keeping. And I don't know why they kept those. So I had to somehow or other establish my credentials as a recruit. And so I did it. I had joined the Army, 64th Field Battery, at Yorkton, Saskatchewan, in the summer of 1940, and just before I finished my last year at university, and was immediately sent off to Camp Dundurn. In fact, I never went near Yorkton. I went straight from my hometown to Camp Dundurn and joined and met with them there. And two things occurred within the first week that I was there. One was we had the National Registration, I think it was.
Wartime registration.
Yeah. I believe that was the 15th of August, 1940. And the other thing was that Gracie Fields came and sang to us.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I said, if you go and look in the newspapers and find out when Gracie Fields sang to the troops of Camp Dundurn in the summer of 1940, you'll have it within a day or two of when I joined. And about a month later, I got back a letter saying, we've checked your sources, and you're right, and we've found the details.
Okay, I see.
I think the 64th Field Battery in Yorkton had gone out of business too, and but they had tracked down the colonel or somebody who had who'd been there and remembered and had some a diary or something. So that's how, after 33 years in the service, I established my credentials for a pension. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
So
amazing, yeah.
I don't trust these tapes and microfilms all that much, even though I'm speaking to a tape right now.
Yeah, well.
So, maybe one day I have to stop now, but maybe one day we might spend about half an hour and I'll just jot down on a piece of paper a few highlights that I have skipped out in these things and might just fit together. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, I'd like to do that. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
That's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again to Commodore A. Graham Bridgman. It's the 5th of August, 1980.
All right. I wondered if you would say a few words about the distribution of the ship construction programs. By distribution, I mean east versus west, Quebec versus Vancouver, Victoria. Did it make any difference to you, or did you feel that the most cost-effective ships could be built in Quebec because the wages were lower, or what were your feelings about this?
Well, if you work on the most cost-effective system, it follows, I think, that sooner or later you end up with one shipyard, the most efficient one in the country, that builds all your ships. The trouble with that is that it's not very good from a defense preparedness point of view. You don't want to have all your eggs in one basket because you're going to get into troubles eventually. Certainly in time of war, you would be in real difficulty. So you want to have a shipbuilding industry and a machinery and electronic and weapons manufacturing industry in the country, which is going to be available to you in time of war. And if you want it to be available to you in time of war, you've got to do something to keep them in business in peacetime. And so... the price you pay for keeping them in business in peacetime is that you you pay more for your equipment and ships in those areas where wages are high than you do in those areas where wages are very low. But I think on balance and over the long run, it works well to have facilities in not one but several areas. And I think I could say that the ships that were built between 1950 and 1960, or between 1950 and 1957 anyway, where they were allocated to the shipyards across the country. I believe that shipbuilding program went very well. We had some of the best ships that were delivered, best quality of workmanship, I think, were delivered from the West Coast shipyards. If it had been a competitive situation, they never would have been in the game at all, because wages on the West Coast are so high that would automatically disqualify them. And I think it's a pity that the government has gone to a system whereby you call for competitive tenders and you not only disqualify a lot of Canadian shipyards in favor of other Canadian shipyards, you disqualify a lot of machinery manufacturers in favor of foreign machinery manufacturers. And as I said at the beginning, you follow that line of action far enough and you end up by one shipyard in Canada assembling all the ships and all of the equipment being imported. And that is not the way to go about having a prepared country, a country that's prepared for war. So I feel that there's going to have to be a step backwards or some sort of a compromise between the rigid competitive bidding that is in vogue now and the old system of allocated contracts on a cost-plus basis.
When did this system come in, the new system?
It came in, as far as my experience was concerned, started with the DDH 280 program in 1964. Up until that time, shipyard contracts had more or less been allocated. But in the 1964 DDH 280 program, that was strictly competitive bidding. And while we called for tenders all across Canada, it was pretty well, I suppose, a foregone conclusion that the West Coast yards mm-hmm. would have had to perform miracles mm-hmm. to qualify. And we saw the result of that. The contracts all went to two shipyards on the St. Lawrence River. The Maritimes were eliminated for productivity, I think, and the West Coast were eliminated on just too high prices.
Yeah. Okay.
So I believe that, don't think there's any point in going into that any greater detail, but I believe that even the Americans, I think, are finding that some of their wonderful programs that they allocated on a very vague specification to single shipyards on a competitive bid got them into all sorts of trouble. And I think we've heard of a lot of lawsuits where the Pentagon is suing the shipyards and the shipyards are suing the Pentagon and so on. Some pretty serious cases have come about as a result of these single contracts.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, what about refits? Now, does it go to competitive bidding for refits? And how do the two dockyards compare or shape up in that?
You can't really bid very competitively on a refit because most of the work that has to be done is not uncovered until you start the work.
Yeah.
It's like taking your car to a garage and taking the cylinder head off. You don't really know how much work you're going to do to that engine until you've got the head off. By that time, it's too late to drive it to some other garage to have the work done.
Right.
So you really have to allocate work on a rotational basis among worthwhile shipyards, those who've shown that they can do a good job and produce it on time.
Yeah. Keeping in mind, I suppose, that the dockyards require a certain amount of work to keep them up to
Yes, yeah, so well, you have to keep the dockyards in the picture, too.
Mm-hmm.
But they should get a percentage of the refits, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look in the dockyards and the St. Lawrence River shipyards and the New Brunswick and Nova Scotia shipyards and the West Coast yards, all in the same group. Yeah. But sooner or later, they've all got to have some work or they go under.
Was there more more concern to keep the dockyards, dockyard organization going than perhaps the...
Well,
the Navy, for example?
The dockyards have to be kept going. You have to have a base. You have to have a place for your ships to come in and tie up,
yeah,
and to receive provisions and emergency repairs over a weekend and all of that sort of thing. Place to store your spare parts and things which you couldn't just leave entirely to industry. And by the time you've got that much plant there, it's not... It is economic to go further and have repair facilities and,
yeah,
and the, you know, general overhaul repair facilities. The Royal Navy go even further and build ships in their dockyards, mm-hmm, but they only build a few, you know. And the three Oberon submarines, which the Canadian Navy acquired during my term of office, were built in the Royal Dockyard at Chatham in England.
How do they stack up on a quality basis? Very well? Or?
They stood up very well,
yeah.
They stood up very well. Mm-hmm. They were good quality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's
fine. HMS Victory, which is still in the dockyard in Portsmouth, which last saw service in Nelson's day, was built in Chatham Dockyard.
Yeah. They have a good reputation then, do they?
And they still have the drawings there that they can produce for you,
yeah,
if you ever want to see them. Yeah.
Good iron.
Yeah. So, no, the dockyards can do well. But the dockyards should not be allowed to grow just at the expense of putting private industry out of business. The dockyards need to maintain a certain size that's necessary to provide that base type of facility that I'm talking about, and then a certain amount of repair work on top of that.
Yeah.
They should be capable of refitting destroyers, but not capable of refitting all the destroyers in the Navy at once. That's
right.
Right. If you had six or seven destroyers that all had to be modernized, well, you don't put them all in the dockyard, but you might give them dockyard one, and shipyard A1, and shipyard B1, and so on.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what the next ship construction program, or how it's handled as far as dockyards, shipyards are concerned.
Well, I think you'll see a swing back. If it's not the next program, it might be the one after that. But I believe that the pendulum went too far when we tried to put everything into one general statement of requirements, if you like,
yeah,
and have people bid on that and then to provide all the drawings and details and so on. Because contractors just aren't capable of doing a lot of the things that the combination of shipyards and the Navy did between them. For example, most contractors don't really know how to go about buying a weapon system, you know, a gun.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's foreign to them. No merchant ship carries guns.
And yeah.
So the shipyards are just not in the business of buying guns.
They don't have armament experts.
So the Navy has to buy the gun from the manufacturer and test it and prove it and everything else and then deliver it to the shipyard to install. But it's not just as simple as that. It's not a question of just bolting something down. It's an intricate mass of wiring and so on. But it becomes a joint effort between industry on the one hand and the military on the other, with each playing its part and attempting to dovetail in between. The moment you say, we're going to stop all that, and we're going to pick one prime contractor, and he's going to supply everything and buy everything and install everything, sounds great, doesn't work.
Yeah, I can see where you'd be in trouble with some specialized equipment like that.
Well, most of the equipment's specialized.
It is specialized,
yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. Thanks very much on that.
Well, if I may, without keeping you much longer, I wanted to just touch on a few random things that have occurred to me as a result of my 30-odd years in the Navy. And first one is the position of civilians in the Navy. The Navy, I think, inherited this characteristic from the Royal Navy, but they ran their dockyards largely with civilians and tended to run the naval headquarters largely with civilians. And in my period in the Navy, we tended to try and have 50% of the Navy afloat. And in order to have 50% of the Navy afloat, you had to have a lot of people ashore who weren't sailors supporting them, because 50% of the shore cannot support the whole Navy. So we're quite accustomed to, I was always accustomed to having large numbers of civilians on my staff, or even working for civilian masters. And I was terribly impressed with the dedication of the civilians, civilian engineers, technical officers, and even clerks and typists. Although they all belonged just to that amorphous mass called the Public Service of Canada, they didn't regard themselves as really belonging to the Public Service of Canada. They regarded themselves as belonging to the Navy. And there was considerable continuity, much more continuity than you would ever believe, and great reluctance to be shifted in order to gain promotion, to have to go and work in some other government department. I only mention this because I think it'll have a place in the future. I think that we should always try to have as much of the work as we can done by civilians in order to have the continuity. We shouldn't ever try to have a military force which is 100% military. And I mention this really just to pay tribute, really, though, to all the civilians that I've known. I think they were just a first-class group of people, and we owe them a lot. And then there were other civilians who were not really employees of the government at all, but somehow or other formed an attachment. And I suppose a typical example would be a Chinese laundryman named Sui Ki, who for years ran a little one-man laundry service in Esquimalt. And when the war broke out, two of the destroyers on the West Coast were in Vancouver, I think, attending the Pacific Exhibition. And they were told to sail immediately for Halifax, not to come back to Victoria. Yeah, so it goes without saying that their laundry was all left behind, and it was in the hands of Sui Ki. When the ships arrived in Halifax 4 or 5 weeks later, who was standing on the jetty with his laundry bag over his shoulder but Sui Ki to meet them?
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And years later, after the war, I didn't know him then, but after the war, when I was serving in the Ontario, and all the ships on the West Coast, the quartermaster, Sui Ki, would arrive at the jetty, and the quartermaster would make a pipe throughout the ship saying, "Sui Ki is on the quarterdeck. You know, Sui Ki is on the quarterdeck." And everybody knew that what that meant. You came with your laundry, and you got your laundry, and you did your business with Sui Ki. And I think before he died, Sui Ki was made an honorary leading seaman in the Navy in some sort of a ceremony that they had here in Halifax.
Really? Yeah.
But he was an institution, you know, and he just, I think, was almost as much a part of the Navy as the people in the Navy. I had another note here I wanted to make. It's something that I missed when I was talking about my service in the HMCS Stonetown during the war. And we spent all our time on convoy work.
Excuse me, you just go back. You were the engineer officer.
I was the engineer officer, yes.
Right.
Although this particular story doesn't have much bearing on that. But one night I was awakened by a loud ring of action stations and the loud bell, and I ran down to the engine room, which is where I had to go in action stations. And I got down there and find that first of all, I should say that Stonetown was in what they call position able, which was the position in front of the convoy. And I found that we arrived in the engine room, but we were going full astern. A couple of minutes later, we were going full ahead, and then full astern. And this went on, I don't know how many times we repeated this cycle. And it was the middle of the night, darkest night you've ever seen in your life.